Hello, this is Daniel Chalkett.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. They defy conventional wisdom. This week's show is sponsored by Digimark and Fabric. Well, Manton, I know you are a strong investor in Twitter. And I'm sorry to report to you that your one share of Twitter is only worth $14.72.
Yeah, I logged into E-Trade yesterday because I was curious about Apple earnings news and stocks, and I don't know, every once in a while I actually have to log in and see what all that stuff looks like, and I was happily greeted by a negative $40 loss on my one share of Twitter, down 70% or something like that. So just one share, so I minimized my loss.
I have to give you credit for picking. You really know how to pick the one share investment.
Yeah, right. If I'm going to invest in a stock that I don't believe in, I'm only going to go in with one share.
Well, yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Twitter is, I honestly think this, not just because they sponsor our show from time to time, often actually, and in fact, are sponsoring today. I honestly think it is a great company, but I don't know what to make of their stock. I mean, yeah, the stock is not doing well, but this week in, this week in stocks of companies we admire, but whose stock performance has faltered.
And that's the thing, right? It's like a company that has the whatever $14 share price, they shouldn't lose hope because it will, I mean, you and I remember when Apple's share was $14 and no one thought that the company
or $6
could
or
$3
after a split adjustment.
Well, right. I was just, yeah, exactly.
No. I mean, I'm not trying to nitpick. I can pick a smaller number than you.
But the point is, yeah.
Yeah.
You got to take the long-term view.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Twitter's market cap is $10 billion. For some reason, I'm looking on Yahoo Finance, and I don't understand, I guess, enough about how they compute the P to E, the price to earnings ratio. I don't understand that enough to know why there's just a blank space for Twitter, because I believe Twitter makes a profit, has earnings, you know?
Right. This is a good time to point out, disclaimer for the rest of the show, this is not
stock
advice. of any kind.
People think they tuned into the wrong show. We're getting somewhere here. Hold on a minute, folks. We're getting something here. But I was hoping that Twitter had a price to earnings ratio listed, because one of the funny things about Apple, one of the most successful, most profitable, highest returning in recent years stocks on the market, is that their price to earnings ratio is minuscule. I mean, compared to many, many companies. Looking at my list right here, Apple's price to earnings ratio is 10.09. For an extreme comparison of companies that happen to be on the list that I sort of pay attention to, Amazon is 483.61. Yeah. That's just amazing. But then you think like, oh, well, that's just because Apple's an old established company. Well, Microsoft's PDE is 35.14, three and a half times what Apple's is. And Microsoft's been doing pretty good lately. Pretty well, I should say. But that means that as a rule, the stock market's looking at Microsoft and saying, we sort of like have three and a half times as much confidence in Microsoft's potential to keep earning like this. I don't know. Well, I mean, that might be naive. That's probably naive.
Yeah. In terms of like, they do feel that.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous at this point. It's just kind of silly, but like, Wall Street does not believe in Apple.
They don't believe
it. Doesn't matter what the earnings are going to be. It doesn't matter how many trillions of devices they ship. They're always looking for some kind of failure. Always looking for the worst possible interpretation of the quarterly results.
It's because they have defied expectations all along, I think.
Yeah.
Probably even from before my time, before your time, knowing about the company or examining the company, at least, because, you know, our age, I never remember your exact age, Manton, but I think you're about my age. I'm 40. We were kids when Apple was founded. In fact, we were babies when Apple was founded. But you can read the history and you can just learn about this amazing company that's like all the way along the way. It's like, you don't think you need personal computers? Well, you do. And then it's like, you don't think you need graphical interfaces? Well, you do. And then it's like, you think you need a floppy drive? Well, you don't. You know, right. you think you need a Walkman? You don't. You think your phone is okay? It's not. You think Apple's a failed company that's going out of business in the 90s? It's not. You think you need our own technology, OpenDoc, which lets you put little modular pieces of code into any app? You don't.
Yeah, the mixed messages over the years. Of course, right. Too.
But I think one of the fun things about being a sort of Apple fan and following Apple is that they defy conventional wisdom in almost everything they do, right? Like we've celebrated some of the other things that they do where it's like we sort of buy Apple's now overt claims that, for example, they don't chase the bottom line, that they have greater ambitions than just making money. And of course, somebody naive from Wall Street or somebody outside of the tech circle or somebody who doesn't sort of have this emotional history of understanding the way Apple behaves would think, well, no, that's bogus. That doesn't align with some people's understanding of the way the world works. And so they look at it and go, nah, that doesn't make any sense. And if you have a company that doesn't make any sense, then what does the stock get priced at? It seems like the stock price for any company has to be kind of like at the lowest common denominator of their decision-making process making sense, right? Like if Apple's just like going to keep making billions of dollars in ways that don't make sense to the average investor, then it doesn't seem like that will be valued in. It doesn't seem like their strategy will be valued into the price because they don't have a discernible strategy for the vast majority of people, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. I'm going to become an analyst now.
Yeah. Well, so this week they did announce their quarterly results. And yeah, disappointing for some people, I guess, down compared to last year. But the thing that stuck out to me was Tim Cook commenting on the iPhone SE. We've mentioned this a few times on the show. A couple weeks ago, we talked about how it's backordered. Still backordered, 2 or 3 weeks. You go into an Apple store today, you're not going to be able to get one. And Tim Cook commented saying that is basically just much greater demand than they even expected. And so they need to ramp up production and, you know, get those phones made.
Turns out there's a lot more Manton Reese's in the world than Tim Cook knew. Could have been like, all right, show of hands, who's Manton Reese? Well, you know, Manton, as an Apple shareholder, another disclaimer I should probably make, and I don't know, Manton, do you have any Apple stock?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so we should both make that disclaimer probably because we're in this big, funny world of financial stuff. So I obviously have an interest in Apple stock continuing to go up, but and it pains me a little bit to look at the Apple stock price right now where it's down to 90. I'm looking at it live on, I guess the stock market's about to close on Thursday here, April 28th, and it's fluctuating around 95. And it's easy to look at that and just say, oh, well, that's just the world reacting to these earnings that, I don't know, frankly, I admit I haven't looked too carefully at, but it sounds like there was a dip in iPhone sales. Did you look at it closely?
I didn't look closely. Like I just saw that, like, I think the quarter a year ago was better.
Right.
And I think there was even one thing that stood out to me is, for the last whatever dozen quarters, it's like record revenue, record, 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 record. And this quarter is like, average.
So I was thinking, oh boy, look at that, took a real beating. And then I looked down on this Yahoo Finance page, which is probably the only thing besides Flickr I use Yahoo for anymore. Also a shareholder in Yahoo, by the way.
Let's just disclaim this at the beginning. Nothing we talk about on the show, we will own stock or have some investment in everything.
Right. But then I saw this news. You know, Carl Icahn, the sort of famous activist investor, years ago, and we talked about this on the show, years ago, he bought up a bunch of Apple. And he was trying to do like this. He was like one of the guys who was really pushing Tim Cook to buy back more of the stock, to like get divest of the cash, all that stuff. So I think Carl Icahn bought a bunch of stock, and then he's like, Carl Icahn's in town now, Tim Cook, so you better step aside. And Tim Cook's like, yeah, I'm Tim Cook. I mean, that was my interpretation of it, was he was like, he gave a little lip service to Carl Icahn, because I think that's sort of what he had to do as a professional who was being addressed by one, a major stockholder at that point. Mm-hmm. But the news I'm looking at here today is Carl Icahn has sold all of his Apple stock. And you think, oh, well, big deal. But then, oh, how much has he sold? Well, since December, he has sold over 45 million shares of Apple stock. Wow. And you and I were sort of talking about this, Manton, before the show. And I think you just did the math where you multiplied 45 times even the conservative $95 a share that it's trading at right now.
It's like several billion dollars.
It's like four. It's like $4 billion.
Yeah.
Well, no wonder the stock is down by 3% today. If you look at the market cap, $525 billion times 3%, 525 times 3, 15.75. I don't know how that math works. Pulling numbers out of thin air, but you know it colors to me. How much the stock is down is colored by the fact that this individual who was in charge of 45 million shares.
So what percentage of the company did he own with that? That's maybe more complicated math, but how many shares? There's like,
I don't know, but I can
6 billion or so.
I can do a rough estimate by saying that since we guessed it was $4 billion worth of shares and there's 525 billion market cap.
Okay.
We could say that it's roughly like less than a percent, but a lot, right? So okay. Like 4 divided by 525. Look at me mess up some more math again here. 4 divided by 525 equals 0.7%.
Okay.
But that's a lot.
That is a lot compared to you and I.
And when, I guess it's a good question. Like, how often does almost a whole percent of Apple stock trade hands?
I would guess almost never, unless there's some, I don't know, executive.
Yeah. And I guess it may be more common than I think in the aggregate of across like all the people trading. So, you know, that would be the volume on the stock market. And I'm looking at the volume today is 68,427,000 shares. And I don't know if Carl Icahn sold all of his 45 million shares today. Probably not, because that would be a dumb investment strategy. Hmm. But, you know, he probably sold it over the course of, you know, the past several weeks, but
right,
it sort of puts, I don't know, colors it for me. Anyway, we don't want to become the Apple stock podcast definitely necessarily, not. But I say necessarily, and you say definitely not. That means like I kind of want to become the Apple stock podcast.
Yeah, I like owning a handful of shares. I don't really have that much. Just because I believe in the company, and I think there's something neat about owning shares in a company you believe in. And I mean, I joked about Twitter, but like, I do believe in a lot of things about Twitter, a lot about what they're doing, a lot of the core product, and a lot of the great stuff they're doing for developers. I talk about on the show a lot. And so that it's just fun sometimes. Yep. And I have a few tech stocks like that. I'm not going to retire off them.
Not off your one share of Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. But it's still kind of something kind of neat about the fact that you can own even a tiny percent of mm-hmm. the company.
It is kind of fun. I mean, and I think this is also something I was talking to you about before the show, Manton. It's clearly a luxury of having any extra money to be able to like invest in such a risky proposition. And it's kind of fun when you do have that luxury to be able to sort of vote for a company in a way.
Yeah.
Say like, hey, I kind of want to. Like, I mean, you wouldn't really put money into something you didn't want to do well. So it's kind of a way of saying, here, I hope you do well.
Yeah.
We are happy to have a new sponsor to the show this week, and it's a company called Digimarc. And with the Digimarc Discover SDK, apps get the best mobile scanner for the most common traditional 1D barcodes. It's lightning fast, super reliable, and inexpensive. App users experience incredible scanning performance, varying distances, perspectives, blur, glare, and challenging barcodes. Not a problem. No more fumbling or frustration. In addition to scanning the most common traditional 1D barcodes, as well as QR codes, the Digimarc Discover mobile SDK also future-proofs apps with the exclusive capability to scan Digimarc barcodes. These are imperceptible codes used in product packaging, print, and audio media for delivering digital product information and content. One software kit, unlimited possibilities. Cool stuff. Check out digimarc.com/mobile SDK for more info.
Yeah, it's funny. When this sponsor approached us about talking about their SDK for developers on the show, I had just been working on an app for a client that did barcode scanning, like QR code scanning, as part of one of the features. And if iOS developers, there's a bunch of different ways to do this, of course. And one of the things I was kind of happily surprised to discover at first was that AV Foundation actually includes some limited scanning, which I used in that client app. But that requires you to like learn AV Foundation and like set up, you know, video capture and like get access to the camera and do a preview view so you can, the user can see what they're doing, and you know, all this kind of work if you just want a quick scan a barcode or something. And so the Digimarc SDK, it basically allows you to get all these features like without doing much of anything. They have a view controller you can use, you know, you add their SDK to your project, you can use their view controller, customize it, and it'll handle, you know, previewing the image, it'll handle actually, you know, recognizing the QR code or whatever it is, and then get a quick callback, and you can do something with the data, whether it's a URL or text or product identifier, whatever it is. And so this would really save you a lot of time. You should definitely look at this SDK if you need any kind of QR code or barcode scanning. And it supports a bunch of different things. And so as in what Daniel read, talked about, like the special Digimarc codes. And one of the things that I was fascinated with is there's some of these like invisible barcodes is the best way to think about it. So for example, one of their customers is the Portland Trailblazers, and they did this thing where they had like a poster of the team, right? The basketball team. And there's no barcode on it that you can see. There's not like an annoying, like ugly QR code in the corner. But they've somehow imprinted the, you know, the barcode information in the poster so that fans that have the poster or they see the poster or a sign or something in the stadium can scan it with the Trailblazers iPhone app, and then they get extra content or something like that. So I thought that's a really clever way to handle these, but it also supports regular QR codes that everyone's seen a million times.
Yeah, I love that idea, Manton, that you could just have one SDK for handling everything from like the basic, what everyone has wanted to do since the beginning of time, 1D barcodes, all the way up through QR codes, and then to this newer stuff that I frankly hadn't even heard about, but it's pretty cool. And if I had an app that said, hey, just point your phone at this poster and you'll get some special stuff, I'd be like, yeah, right. That's not going to work.
Right.
So it's a good example, I think, too, of taking something that's a common use case, adding a little bit of magic and putting it all together in one framework that handles everything from kind of like, let's face it, kind of the old and boring barcodes up to some of this new stuff. Even audio media. So there's a lot of stuff to dig into here, but you can learn more about it if you have any kind of app you're working on, or if your company works on an app that can use scanning of these kinds of codes, then you should really check out Digimarc, and you can learn more again, as I said, at digimarc.com/mobile SDK. Thanks so much to Digimarc for sponsoring the show.
So Daniel, since we last talked, WWDC tickets, obviously the lottery had started last week, and then people started getting picked, and unfortunately people also started not getting
picked. Like you and me.
Right.
You and I. I'm just going to correct my grammar all this. We're going to have a new podcast. It's going to be the Financial Stocks and Daniel Self-Correcting Grammar Podcast.
So last week, I was kind of excited about the venue change, like, the conferences, it's new, this might be something interesting here. And you really kind of talked me down, saying, you're crazy.
You think you're worth WWDC? You're not worth WWDC.
And I assume that you didn't put your name in the hat for the conference after all.
I did not. And did you?
So I actually did.
Whoa. And you didn't get it, though?
And I did not get in. It kind of was a little bit of a long story, but I wasn't planning. You did a good job of talking me down. I was not planning on going to the main conference. Then I was talking to a friend of mine, John Hayes, who I've done work, some subcontracting work for recently.
That guy's a bad influence.
we're working on a project right now together. And he was like, you know what, just put your name in the hat and we'll expense it as part of work that we're doing.
Well, hello. That sounds good.
And so I said, are you sure? Like, I wasn't planning on going.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, do it. And so I was like, okay.
Wow.
And so I put my name in there.
That's a nice friend. Nice friend slash employer. Yeah.
But didn't get picked. It was actually kind of funny because I had already booked my flight to come back Thursday. And so I'm not going to say I was relieved that I didn't get a ticket, but I would have had to rethink my plans for the week if I did get a ticket, because I was already set on, I'm just going to go out for a few days. I'm going to leave Thursday, lunchtime or whatever. And as we talked about on the show, it really seems like a waste to have a conference ticket and not take advantage of most of the week, right?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, that's what I did every time I had a conference ticket.
Well, especially now, though, where the demand is so high, there's another developer out there that wants a ticket that could be there all day, Monday through Friday. They could go to the bash on Thursday. They could go to labs. It just only half the week doesn't feel like a great use of the time. So if I had gotten a ticket, I would have had to think about, do I stay till Friday? Do I give someone else my badge?
I'll tell you what, Manton, if you ever have this problem again where somebody else buys you a ticket and you have to leave on Thursday, then you can just give me the ticket and I promise I'll go do something at WWDC.
Woohoo. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. And I would have in the past, I might have felt weird about borrowing someone's badge or giving someone my badge. But with the demand so high and so few people that can really go, I wouldn't feel bad about that at all, because I think that's the right way to use the resource that Apple is providing, honestly. And if a company can only send, I mean, the unfortunate end of this story is, John didn't get a ticket either. His business partner didn't get one either. So it was like 0 for 3 on that, which kind of sucks. But for small companies that have a handful of people and only two people out of 10 get a badge and they share the badge, I mean, I'm sure Apple doesn't like that, but honestly, I think that's okay.
I don't, and to be honest, I've heard mixed feedback about that. I feel like it almost might be Apple legal doesn't like it, but Apple technical does,
or
something like that. The spirit, one of the best things, I know I've been a little bit grumpy about WWDC for a few years here, but one of the best things about that conference is every single individual who speaks at the conference, I think, in the quote unquote quality of the speaker varies greatly. And it can be kind of a dud talk if the person's not very dynamic or whatever. But even that most dud talk, the person is, I think they're excited about what they work on and they want to share it with everybody. And that's the best part about WWDC. And those people, I believe there are very few of those people who could care less whether you gave your badge to somebody who was going to use it because they were excited to come learn about that new technology that they've been working on.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. They want that room full of people.
They want that room
to hear about whatever API, no matter how obscure it might seem to some people.
That's right. And it's the only possible way it could hurt Apple is if you used badge swapping in such a way that you used more resources of the conference than a person who went and stayed the whole time would. So for example, if you were super clever and you really couldn't get enough of those mediocre lunches, and you're like, all right, I got mine, you go. And you went in and you're like, all right, now your turn. And you come out and you got one badge, 5 lunches. Right. Whereas the vast majority of my friends who got tickets to WWDC would always be not even going to go to the lunch.
Right.
So it's pretty contrived. I mean, if you take it as granted that by buying a badge, you have sort of rented space for one person inside the conference for the whole week, then I think it's ethically very defensible to loan badges and share badges.
Yeah. And again, it might be different if everybody could buy a ticket if they felt like it, but that is not the reality at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I had mentioned last week also the idea, like the only other thing that would maybe be a little bit of a concern is I had the idea that maybe they could oversell the conference a little bit, knowing that a lot of people aren't going to be there late in the week.
Yeah.
And I've actually, I have a blog post I wrote about this. I haven't had a chance to like kind of wrap it up and post it. So it's a little bit stale now, but after thinking about it for a few days, I've come around to thinking that's actually a really bad idea. And I like the idea of having a lot of people there on Monday in a bigger venue and then fewer people necessarily the rest of the week. And the fewer people, actually the people that really need to be there, developers. But I don't think Apple would ever risk overselling the conference like a, you know, airplane.
They don't need to. And in a way, that's what the tacit approval like of badge sharing accommodates, is it says, you know, we're not going to, like, I think that sort of like, and I say tacit approval because I kind of have the impression that they look the other way a little bit on the badge sharing, because they could certainly be more hard about that, I think. That's a better solution, sort of like looking the other way about badge sharing is a better solution than trying to like milk more registration money out of people. And the last thing Apple needs, even with their stock depressed to $95 per share, is like a few hundred or even 1,000 more paid registrations to WWDC. You know, like talk about noise. So and I've always heard that actually WWDC, even in spite of its significant cost to those of us who would pay as individuals, I've always heard that it's not really a money-making venture anyway. Like the money they put into it isn't covered by the registration cost. And it makes sense when you consider not just like the lavish, work they put into the space, not just like the beer bash and hiring the big fancy band and all the insurance and security guards and all that stuff, but they're paying for a huge number of their own relatively high paid Silicon Valley engineers to spend a week in San Francisco not doing their regular job.
Yeah, it doesn't make money. There's no way. No. I'm sure they lose money, but they don't really lose money though, because Apple's not the kind of company that like treats one week of profits compared to the next. I mean, they have the big picture in mind, and it overall it's a huge benefit for them to have it. It's an expense, but it's a huge benefit.
Yeah,
I mean, related. I don't think that like the App Store should be a profitable revenue source, or at least a like extremely profitable revenue source for Apple. I think they disagree now. Like they, as they're doing more services, they do think the App Store should be a revenue source.
Mm.
I'm annoyed by that personally, because it's easy to complain about the 30%, and I will continue to complain about it for as long as I'm a developer. But I think that's a slight difference, in that some things that Apple does for developers are a source of revenue, and some, specifically with developer relations and with WWDC, are not and shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is also like could have been a source of revenue back in the bad old days when Apple was poor, but now it's like just a gate fee, like the Apple developer membership, right? It's gone from being $500 minimum per year to $100 for each platform per year to $100 across the board per year.
So I agree with what you're saying, but if I were going to nitpick, I would say it went from $0 to $500. I mean, it didn't used to cost anything to be a Mac developer. Now it does.
Well, it never, no, you always got something for the five. You didn't have to pay the $500 a year.
Yeah. But now to be an iPhone developer, you really do have to
$99
a year.
What did you get for the, oh yeah, that's right. If you paid the $500 a year, you got a discount on hardware that usually, if you were a big fancy hardware buyer, exceeded the $500.
Right. You got a couple technical support incidents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right, though. No, you do have... Well, here's the other thing. It's complicated because you don't, again, you don't have to pay to be a developer per se. You have to pay to be an app store seller.
Right. To be someone who actually distributes iOS software, you have to be a paid developer. I guess with a Mac you still can do it free, I guess, because you can download mm-hmm. Xcode for free. And, you know, you can continue to ship.
Sell directly, but you can't, the rub there is you can't do developer ID.
I was about to say that, yeah. So you could do it, but users will get the annoying prompt when they launch your app.
What part of my, like, elitist 40-year-old privileged white guy living in the United States owning Macs and multiple iOS devices attitude is that anybody who's developing for these platforms can probably afford the $100 fee.
Yeah. And the truth is, too, that's actually pretty cheap compared to, I mean, I said it used to be free, but
yeah,
it would actually cost quite a bit to get good developer tools.
That's
back
true.
In the old
yeah.
days.
Well,
and
there
I
was
remember
a, yeah.
I was young and I like would save up my money and get the you know, educational discount for like whatever, Semantic C++ or something like that, or Code Warrior later. And it was still like $100+ or something.
Yep.
And then the full price was hundreds of dollars usually for those tools.
It's a great way to look at it. The MetroWorks was several hundred dollars mm-hmm. and it was great software, but and people complain and whine about Xcode and boy, there's a lot to complain about, but free. It's free. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But gather around the campfire, kids, and Grandpa and Grandpa will tell you another story.
Well, I'm excited about the conference. I didn't get a ticket. I'm going to be out there. I did book my flight, be out there Sunday morning early until Thursday. AltConf is starting to announce speakers. That's going to be fun. What have you thought? Have you booked a flight? I think you have right now.
I did. I booked it. I'm feeling pretty good about it. You know, I was pretty up in the air about it. I did end up booking it. I think maybe I booked it the night of talking to you. And just like I was looking at that OmniFocus thing I mentioned last week, you know, book a ticket to WWDC. I was like, you know, I better just look. And I looked and it was like, turned out that there were some pretty reasonable flights like on Virgin, which I guess, you know, even after being sold to Alaska is probably still going to be better than some choices. And it was like only $400-something round mm-hmm. trip. So
yeah, about the same here. I was a little annoyed that it actually went up almost $100 since I checked to when I actually booked it, but that's how it goes.
Yeah, that sucks. But, I felt like I wasn't getting too ripped off, and I felt like the potential to get ripped off far more would only grow. And
yeah,
it was just one of those things where I kind of thought, you know, truth is I like being in San Francisco at WWDC. It's an overwhelming social anxiety experience in some ways. And that's not an experience that's not a problem that everybody contends with, but I bet a lot of people do to some extent or another. And, you know, some people don't deal with that at all. And some people, like myself, I think sort of deal with it in spurts. Like, I'll just be like, hey, I'm out. I'm having fun. This is great. And then I'll be like, I just need to go, like, bury under a pillow or something. So I have a little bit of a complicated mixed experience with it. But I think the good outweighs the bad, you know, so it's kind of something to just steel myself for and get ready to go in and have a good time and just meet a lot of people, and it'll be fun. I'm glad you're going to be there. I'll be there.
And, you know, I think so in the years past, and I'm kind of springing this on you, we haven't talked about this at all, but, you know, sometimes people ask, you know, they want to say hi or something. And we randomly run into a lot of people that listen to the show, which is fantastic. But I wonder if maybe this year we should do a better job of saying, you know, let's meet up at a certain time on a certain day, you know, even if it's just some informal thing.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying like have a big thing, not sell tickets, not, you know, maybe just a couple people. It doesn't even matter. But like for anyone that does want to like chat and talk about the podcast or just say hi, maybe have do a better job of saying, yeah, we'll have a little time to hang out.
Well, yeah, let's keep that in mind for sure. It already starts to stress me out thinking about when that would be. No, but that's okay. No, that's okay. Let's keep that in mind. And I do want to mention, though, to listeners, if you're not on our CoreInt Slack at chat.coreint.org and you are going to be in San Francisco for WWDC or just to hang out around the periphery, I proposed this in the WWDC channel on our chat, which is that can serve as a kind of like organizing hub.
Oh, maybe that's a better way to handle it. You're right.
Maybe we'll have like several, like, hey, we're going to be here at this time for 2 hours. Anybody who can make it, show up. And that would be one way to sort of try to get people together, but maybe not have like the planning phase.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. Bottom line is we're not great at the planning. And I think that it would stress us out and add too much. But yeah, I think that's a good idea. There's a lot of people in the Slack channel. And if you're listening and you want to say hi or whatever during WWDC week, maybe join the Slack channel and kind of poke in that week. And we'll post something if it works out.
I like that plan. Thanks, Slack, for sponsoring the show. All right, our second sponsor today on the show this week is our friends at Twitter and, of course, their Fabric SDK. Boy, we've talked about it a lot, but there's a lot to talk about, and there's always something new. Of course, you know them from way back in the day when they were sponsoring us as Crashlytics. Crashlytics was acquired by Twitter and was a keystone in their Fabric SDK, which now, of course, offers various services, lots of frameworks to help mobile developers, including stuff like Crashlytics for crash reporting. They have stuff for authenticating mobile users. They have analytics stuff. And then they added this opportunity to easily embed a bunch of third-party frameworks, including stuff like Mapbox. You just can use Fabric as the sort of hub for a bunch of really great, reliable third-party and Twitter-created frameworks for your mobile development. And I feel like a broken record here almost every time I come on the show to talk about Fabric, highlighting the fact that they're always coming out with new stuff. And boy, they make it easy because they are always coming out with new stuff. And on the Fabric blog at fabric.io/blog, of course, they have a new announcement introducing Fabric Mission Control. And this looks really cool. It's like taking the idea that you might be using Fabric for your app and then extending that to the likely possibility that after a while you're going to have more than one app. And if you work at a company that has multiple apps, that's already the case. But looks like this is something that just sort of takes the already really cool reporting dashboard for Fabric and makes it more useful for multiple apps. And Manton, I think you've had a chance to take a look at this, right?
Yeah, I actually saw it just because I went to Fabric to look something up. Before I even saw this announcement, I looked at the page like, oh, this looks new. This looks like it's been refreshed and updated, and there's more information and here. And so then I actually looked out to the blog just to kind of get the details. And yeah, they've done a great job of rolling out these new features and these kind of like minor redesigns of their dashboard. And it's handy because, yes, like you said, chances are someone has more than one app. So I have a few apps that I've built and shipped myself for my own little indie company, but I also have like client apps and stuff, in Fabric. And so it does a really nice job of, you can see a lot of kind of dense information and you can kind of scroll through it. And then you can do things like let's say I just want to favorite like a couple of my own apps and those all go to the top. And so at a glance, you can see, active users, percentage of users that are crashing, if there's any new issues or new crashes in the last week or so. So a lot of information in a small space. It's really handy. So thanks again to Crashlytics, Fabric, and Twitter for sponsoring the show. And you can learn more at fabric.io.
Well, Manton, we are, as you know, one of the world's preeminent Swift podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Because basically since day one, we've been like 100% Swift 100% of the time.
Yeah. We're always on the cutting edge. So we mention Metrics codeware early in the show. I still use that. I've hacked in Swift support.
Swift support. No, no. Oh my God. Swift.mcp.
Yeah. The funny thing is, I am actually this week, I think I can say this week, we're recording on a Thursday, I have only coded in Swift, I think, which is new.
You know, I can't make quite that claim, but I have turned the corner to where every new class I consider adding to my project, I consider adding it in Swift first. Mm-hmm. And usually I end up, I mean, I'm not like adding a bunch of files, so this maybe adds up to like three or four classes so far, but usually I do make the decision to go to Swift. The only times when I don't are when I anticipate some kind of nasty dynamic Objective-C runtime manipulation. And I'm like, that's just going to be harder to do in Swift. True or not, it might not be true anymore, but I think it's still probably on the whole is true. But I know that my learning curve isn't there yet.
Yeah, and you know, you did a great thing in terms of actually reading through the whole language guide before jumping in. I still haven't actually done that, and it's kind of setting me back a little bit. So I basically, as I'm working, I have the Swift language guide open, and I'm still at the point where I frequently have to go into it and look something up. Here's how I code in Swift. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I type some stuff. It doesn't work. I add as many exclamation points and question marks as possible. If it still doesn't work, then I look at the Swift language guide.
Oh my God! Don't ever. We're gonna cut this in post.
I don't know.
No, it's all right. I mean, I have a little bit of that too. I thank you for admiring my reading of the manual, but unfortunately, it didn't prevent me also still needing to go back to the reference guide repeatedly. And sometimes I go back and I'm like, did I really read this? Like, because I sort of feel like, oh, how does this work? But it's sinking in. And I wish I could put my finger on it, especially for the purpose of explaining to people who are still real curmudgeonly about Swift. I wish I could put my finger on it, but something just feels right to me.
Hmm.
And I don't know if you've had that feeling yet. You might just be sort of like working under duress of, quote unquote, kind of having to use Swift, but
I have that feeling sometimes, but it's not universal. Like I joked about the question marks and stuff. That is still something that I'm having trouble getting over.
Yeah.
Like just how different a language it is than Objective-C.
Yeah.
In terms of optionals and just making sure you tell the compiler everything you could possibly tell it. That I'm still having trouble with that. But there are parts of the language that are very elegant that I do like.
Well, here, so some of this I think boils down to like how much do you appreciate a compiler or a language being a hard ass? Right? And I think this is really, I think that's kind of a funny statement in isolation, but I think that there's really something to that as far as like the resistance that people have to Swift from the Objective-C community. There's been a history. One, I think a lot of people who love Objective-C sort of love that the compiler has not been a hard ass. Far from it, right? Like, you want to send a message to that object? It's cool, bro. Just, you know, we'll see how it goes. You'll find out at runtime whether it worked or not. And there's a lot of like particular patterns where that makes sense. Like it's something you do want. You want to have dynamic dispatch. You want to have the ability to determine at runtime whether an object can handle something. There's some things about Swift that are just really opinionated and really impose limitations on you. The one thing that comes to mind is the whole kind of first class nature of immutability in Swift, right? You've probably gotten a taste of this.
Yeah.
And in a nutshell, for those of you who haven't dug into Swift yet, you declare the mutability of a variable in Swift not by the choice of class, like you would in Objective-C or with the traditional Cocoa frameworks, where in Objective-C in the frameworks, you would say, I need this thing to be mutable, so I'm going to allocate an NS mutable array. And in Swift, you don't declare it by the name of the class. You declare it by the class of the variable. That's too confusing to put it that way, but like the storage class of the variable, more precisely. So in Swift, you would say like, let my array equal array is an immutable array, and var my array equal array is a mutable array. And some folks noticed that this is a pretty big impedance mismatch between the traditional Cocoa APIs and Swift. So there was this great like pull request that went around like on Twitter and the blogs and stuff. It's a pull request to make basically a bunch of Cocoa's basic types sort of have magical mutability or an immutability in Swift. Based on that let or var usage. So I'll put a link in the show notes, but there's a pull request called mutability and foundation value types. And it looks real serious. It looks like one of these, it's not a pull request, I'm sorry. It's one of the Swift evolution proposals.
Right.
But it's one of these that looks like it's on the road to happening. You know, it's got like, I'm looking at it right now. It's got like authors. The author is Tony Parker, an Apple employee. The review manager is Chris Lattner. It's like, mm-hmm. This thing's getting serious attention, right?
Well, that's a big change too. That's a thing that I am hitting, even in my basic use still, I'm hitting a lot of kind of deprecated or changed things.
Yeah.
And that's going to continue. That's just going to be life this year. And maybe forever, but definitely before up until 3.0. And which is weird. It's not often that, like, you search for example code or something, and it just doesn't compile.
Yeah.
Like that, I'm not used to that happening. And usually it's obvious. I'm like, oh, I can see this is kind of the old way to do things. And the compiler is actually pretty good sometimes about catching those and making it easy to fix them. But I'm not used to that kind of thing happening. I'm used to deprecations, of course, in APIs, but mm-hmm. at a language level, code actually not even compiling. It's kind of strange.
Yeah, and now everybody who adopted Swift on day one is like, you think you've got it bad?
Right.
Yeah. Right? Because I was saying this in chat with some friends the other day. I was like, you know, I know I was a little bit of a grump about adopting Swift, and you and I both, Manton, on this show were skeptical. You know, yeah. We were cautiously, I think I would say we were cautiously optimistic, actually. I think from day one, we were saying Swift is in all likelihood the future. There's going to be some growing pains. There's going to be some rifts. It's going to be doesn't feel like it's time for us to jump in yet. And then we got some flack for that. People like, you are, you know, small minded. You don't know what the future is. We had one fan. I'll just call him a fan who gave us a lot of flack about some of our choices. And I have to say, I feel pretty smug about it now, Manton, because I've like crossed the line. I'm on the opposite side now. I'm like, hey, it's time to go to Swift.
Mm-hmm. And we kind of, even on those earlier skeptical days, we kind of knew that there would be a point where it would no longer make sense to kind of fight things. There would come a point where it'd be like, yeah, if you just jump in, this is the time where things get easier.
And I really do feel pretty vindicated in that choice. Like, I skipped a lot of confusing, needlessly difficult adaptations of Objective-C to Swift. And yes, maybe if I had gone through that, I would be a stronger developer today in some respects, but I got a lot of other stuff done in the meantime. And I like Swift 2, you know, I like Swift 2.2 to be precise. And I think I'm going to like Swift 3 a lot more. I know some people are still holding out for Swift 3, but I'm comfortable now. I'm comfortable with the risk of having to adapt some things moving forward. You know, for example, this evolution thing I just linked to. So the gist of it is basically like, you'll be able to say stuff like, let my array equal NS array, and better example, you'll be able to say var my array equals NS array, and it'll be actually an NS mutable array or something like that. I might not be saying that precisely right, but the idea being you don't have to you don't have to, the argument is you don't have to lie about what the type, the immutability type is in Swift just to get it to work in. Because you have the situation, I think, now where you could say, let my array equal NS mutable array.
Right.
And then I think you can mutate that.
Yeah. That's a big change, really.
Yeah.
It really kind of changes the interpretation of let and var. It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, it'll probably break some code I just wrote yesterday. But I think I remember writing some code similar to this, and I'm still so new at Swift that my brain did kind of trip a little bit about, like, wait a minute, I'm using let here. Is that appropriate? And of course, it's fine. But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I've run into a couple things already with the let and var. In particular, bridging to Objective-C code, if the compiler can't tell that it's a property, then it lets you make the change. Like, for instance, like if I make a let instance of a Cocoa or a Objective-C backed class of my own that has like old and busted accessors instead of properties, and so it has like set name, let's say, it will let me, I don't know exactly, it'll let me like do mutating things to that object, mm-hmm. as long as it's not in the form of a property. And so there's some weird like growing pains there.
I wonder, I guess, and when I said it breaks, it may not actually break. Because I'm wondering if you have code right now that says like let S, you know, mutable string, whatever, will that kind of code break, or would it just not be preferred? You know, like, you know what I mean? It's like, I guess there's a difference between like breaking old code and then kind of enhancing code.
Right.
So doing the right thing, kind of. I don't know. This weird. I need to look at the proposal before I talk about it, because there's some weird things that I'm kind of thinking about through this change.
Yeah.
And it also gets to the, you know, how much magic. There's some nice kind of magic in Swift in terms of figuring out what type of variable, you know, you're dealing with. But I could see you possibly could take that too far in some cases. Which is, it's such a weird language, because in some cases it's doing a lot for you and you're typing less. But in other cases, it's the opposite. You know, in some cases it's like, no, you have to be more explicit and more, you know, telling the compiler even more things than you had to before. I don't know if I'll ever get over that kind of shift. But
yeah, I guess I'm a little bit more willing to give in to my compiler overlords. Maybe it's because my dad was a compiler engineer, so it's in my blood to give in to the compiler.
Yeah, it's a fun time. You know, we'll see. I'm all in now, sort of. I mean, I'm not going to go back and rewrite old code, or not going to do a whole lot in Swift on existing Objective-C projects right now. But
yeah,
for new projects, I think I've passed the point where I can be. I'm still not as productive. You know, I'm still not able to build an app from scratch as fast as I could in Objective-C, but getting closer. I can see how in, you know, a year or whatever, you know, I'll be probably as productive. And yeah. I don't know if I'll ever reach the point where I won't like kind of second guess if this was the right direction. Honestly, I mean, even though I like Swift a lot, like I think there are arguments still that say, no, this was, you should have done Objective-C 3.0. And I'm not going to like rehash that whole thing, but like, I don't know if I'll ever totally get over that, but maybe in 6 months or a year, I'll be so on board with Swift that it would be a non-issue.
Well, Apple's history is peppered with choices that were possibly not the ideal choice, but nonetheless turned out to be extremely successful.
Yeah. And a lot of times they actually, you could make an argument that they were the wrong choice.
Yeah.
But they stuck with them and improved those wrong choices so much that it like, they turned them into a great choice. Like there's several technologies. You could almost say the whole thing about Next Step. I mean, it's hard to say that the Next acquisition was a mistake. I mean, you got Steve Jobs, you got all the great Next stuff, you got Cocoa, but I mean, you could have said they could at the time they could have made a different choice that maybe it would have worked out better or faster. I mean, who knows? It's easy to kind of go back and second guess things, but they are so good about taking a choice whether it was right or wrong and iterating on it and improving it. And then surprise, you've got something great.
Surprise, you've got sandboxing. Oh! All right. Well, Manson, we better wrap this show up. People have got things to do. We've got things to do. And of course, though, we have next week to look forward to. And who knows what kind of crazy Swift lessons we'll have learned by then.
Sounds good. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the show. Of course, check out the jobs board. If you're looking to hire or get a new job doing iOS, Mac development, anything Cocoa, anything Swift, it's free to post there. It's at jobs.corent.org.
And of course, I mentioned it earlier, but you are all welcome to join us on the Core Intuition Slack team, which is chat.corent.org. And as always, please consider passing on the news of our podcast and the fact that you love it to your friends who you think might also love it. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.